Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza on this live broadcast from Washington. Here are some of the top stories making news across Sudan and South Sudan this Friday, September 15, 2023. The head of a peace monitoring body in South Sudan says the parties to the 2018 peace agreement should stop blame games.
There is still mistrust between the parties. Secondly, I think there is also an element of lack of political will to undertake this process.
And disabled people in Western Equatorial State capital Yambio call for help.
God gave me this talent to be doing it to help myself. And organizations that know where we are and the things we do, they will come and buy, and it helps us.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. The head of the Reconstituted Joint Monitoring and Evaluation Commission, or RJMAC, says lack of trust among the signatories of the 2018 Revitalized Peace Agreement remains a major obstacle to the implementation of the deal. For VOA News, Wake Simon would report from Juba.
General Gitwai says the signatories of the peace deal have not completed drafting the permanent constitution, implementing security arrangements, formation of the Political Parties Council, and a reconstitution of the National Elections Commission.
There is still mistrust between the parties. Secondly, I think there is also an element of lack of political will to undertake this process. And thirdly, I also say probably there is some bit of capacity gaps in terms of what action should be taken and how do we operationalize these particular legal frameworks. And also one more important thing that we've always been hearing from the government is that there is lack of funding. So this becomes a big issue then, because some of these things require funding, but some of them do not actually require funding. Some could have been acted upon.
Gitwai says a trust deficit could affect the smooth implementation of South Sudan's 2018 peace deal.
We have seen a situation where there is a lot of suspicion in terms of decision-making. There is an element of mistrust between the parties, the agreement. We have seen less or insufficient political will to undertake certain actions.
Peter Lomode, a member of the South Sudan Opposition Alliance, OSHOA, adds that lack of political will hinders the effective implementation of the agreement. He blames the SPLM led by President Salva Kiir for doing very little to implement the peace agreement.
The way forward is that the parties, they should generate the political will through engaging one another in a honest discussion. Number two, it is important also to look at the options, because now these requirements, some of them, given the timeline, some of them may not be fulfilled. So it is important that the parties agreement, they should engage to see what is the possible way to go about the issue of the election.
Government spokesperson and Minister of Information Michael Makwe says funding gaps and a UN Security Council arms embargo imposed on the country in 2018 have hindered the implementation of security arrangements. He blames other signatories of the peace agreement for hindering the implementation of the peace deal too.
It is not all the parties who do not have the political will. There are some parties whom I believe they don't have the political will. And these are the people who have now started talking about the extension. These are people who do not have the political will. These are the people who are saying the impossible, that we cannot proceed again, we cannot go for elections, but we need to go for another extension of 24 months. This is absent of a political will.
Gitwai says he believes the parties need to get back to the drawing board and implement the peace deal before the conduct of elections in 2024.
I would call upon the leadership in this country to really rethink this so that we don't get back to square one. If you go for elections without having been able to achieve some of these things that are critical even to election itself, then how do we now be able to really say that we're going to have a free and fair election where, for example, the constitutional framework is not in place or the parties have not agreed with the way forward in terms of how they want to undertake the elections?
Pokoboth Baluang, acting spokesperson of the SPLMI or loyal to South Sudan's first vice president, Riek Machar, says he agrees that lack of political will and resources are some of the challenges facing the signatories of the deal.
Only the chapter one, which is the covenants, that we can see there's a progress made, and approximately something like 70% has been implemented from that chapter. However, we still remain with the independent institutions. Some of them they are not established, and some has not been reconstituted yet.
The transitional period of the transitional government of national unity has been extended to 2024. The parties to the 2018 peace deal are left with around 15 months to complete the remaining tasks and prepare the country for elections. For VOA News, I'm Waki Simon Wudu in Juba.
Still in Juba, on this International Democracy Day, South Sudanese analysts and some civil society activists are calling on the government to create a conducive environment for conducting general elections in 2024. For VOA News, Dimo Silva Aurelio reports from Juba.
Luka Byung Deng, a policy analyst with the Juba-based Sud Institute, says holding elections by 2024 could set a better foundation for democracy in South Sudan. Byung spoke at an event organized by a coalition of human rights activists to mark International Democracy Day and discuss the state of democracy in South Sudan and the challenges ahead of the 2024 general elections. He says elections are part of democracy for building social contracts between the citizens and their leaders.
At least we are going to have leaders who will know the power of the people, that they are in the offices because of the people. And that's what that feeling is very important. Second, the international community will know, indeed now we have a legitimate government. We are facing the challenge of legitimacy.
Jacqueline Nasiwa, a member of the South Sudan Human Rights Defenders Network, says South Sudan's shrinking civic space is not healthy for holding democratic elections.
The freedom of assembly and the freedom of association, these are the civic space we talk of. So communities need to be able to sit, citizens need to be able to sit and decide how they want to vote and who they want to vote. They need to hold meetings to discuss what are their priorities that they need to ask their leaders when they come for campaigns. These are all important things. And also for political space, the public rallies, they need to be allowed so that we can talk about free and fair environment for everybody. And then we don't have complaints.
Rhea William, the executive director at local NGO for Crown the Women, says she believes young people in South Sudan are afraid to express their opinions on how the country is governed.
Protection of human rights defenders, especially the youth. You know, we've had so many young people leave the space, leave the country, because once you're there and you've been picked on, no one will come to support you. They will say, kasma takide, you know, shrink your mouth. So some people just decide, you know, let me just keep quiet.
President Kiir said early this week that elections should be held on time. The country's first vice president, Riek Machar, told a gathering in Juba last week that the conditions necessary for holding elections are not in place, adding that the delays in completing security arrangements, agreement, and the repatriation of refugees and the conduct of census could affect the timely conduct of elections in South Sudan. For VOA News, I am Dimo Silva Aurelio, reporting from Juba.
From Juba, we move to Western Equatorial State, where people living with disability are appealing to the state and national governments to provide them with resources and income. Western Equatorial State Minister of Gender and Social Welfare says the state government has plans for people living with disability but lacks sufficient funds. For VOA News, Juliana Shiapai reports from Yambio.
Simon Bigirio has been living with paraplegia or leg paralysis for years. It's a condition that results into the loss of muscles function in the lower half of the body, including both legs. He says he makes traditional hats for sale and shoe repair for a living.
I do all these things so that it can help me. I use this talent so that it can help me in the future because I do not have other ways. God gave me this talent to be doing it to help myself. And organizations that know where we are and the things we do, they will come and buy and it helps us.
Sarah Yotoma, a mother of four, is disabled. She makes necklaces, bracelets, and earrings out of beads to earn a living. She says she cannot afford to pay school fees for her children.
I tried with one, but I cannot continue with the other three children. How to do business that can sustain us and pay school fees? It is difficult for me. And most of the people who used to support me have passed on. It is only me trying, but I do not have much ways since I'm living with disability. Even feeding is difficult.
Many South Sudanese are experiencing insecurity, a lack of access to basic services, and increasing inequalities. Pastoralist and agropastoralist communities in remote borders areas are particularly affected by insecurity and by a lack of social services, and women particularly are marginalized. The Minister of Gender, Child and Social Welfare in Western Equatorial State says the government has no funds to cater for the disabled. Cecilia Anigunde says the state government is concerned with the plight of people living with disability.
The government is looking forward to visit them in their center, but the challenges is lack of funding to do the job well. It is not difficult for the government to give support, but they are hoping to see changes soon and get some fundings to help some people living with disability.
A Lutheran church outreach program called Hands of Mercy has been providing skills training to people living with disabilities in Western Equatorial State since 2005. Peter Anibechi Abia is the bishop of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in South Sudan and Sudan. He says the church has stepped up efforts to help vulnerable groups to enable them to earn a living.
Our church decided to start this center where people with disabilities can gather, learn skills, through which they can use to sustain themselves. We teach them the Word of God is number one. We teach them language skills, especially English. We teach them how they can start small businesses to sustain their lives.
Abia says the center is open to all people living with disability, regardless of whether they were born with a disability, experienced it after birth, or if they became disabled during the war. A Lutheran church deaconess from a partner church in the United States of America funds the Hands of Mercy Center. Stephen Jason Parise, acting manager of Hands of Mercy, says the center used to host 30 people living with disability, but 5 passed on. The remaining 25 live and learn skills from the center every day.
We're facing so much challenge we're facing here, because, you know, people with disability is not able to do anything. Some of us who has grown no leg, we not have a knife room. Number one also, we not have a partnership. People are with the disability, the government was not support us. Since we open these places, they are not coming to visit us here. So we depend on ourselves. So we really we appeal to any Joe who needed to support us. The way is free for them. Let them come and see our office and visit us.
Joyce Agi is the manager at the Hands of Mercy Home for People with Disabilities. She says it's fulfilling to serve people living with disability.
As a person looking after people with disability, I am here to let you know that people living with disability are very grateful. They thank me and thank their God all the time. Since you do not experience it firsthand like me, I want to voice it to our government by appealing from them to look after people with disability. We also thank each and every one of you who give support on the road. Sometimes when we are working, people feel pity and give support with some money.
Agi cooks for the disabled people 3 times a week, and she has been doing it for the past 5 years. The Hands of Mercy Center for People Living with Disability offers training in tailoring, sewing of shoes, and handcrafts to help vulnerable groups living in Yambio. 4.8% of South Sudan's population live with disability. For VOA News, I am Juliana Shapai in Yambio, Western Equatorial State.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, Sudan's conflict is threatening to engulf the country. Stay tuned for latest update from our studio guest right after this break. You're listening to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. Sudan is stuck in a brutal conflict that has raged for 5 months, claiming thousands of lives and uprooting millions of people from their homes. In his recent address to the United Nations Security Council, the outgoing UN envoy to Sudan issued a dire warning of impending full-scale civil war if the ongoing hostilities between Sudan's army and the rapid support forces continues. The UN envoy also strongly denounced both warring factions for serious violations, including indiscriminate attacks on civilians, ethnic targeting, and sexual violence. To gain more insights into the origins of the crisis and the potential solutions, we are joined in the studio by Sudan expert Khulod Kheir, the founding director of the Khartoum-based think tank Confluence Advisory. Welcome to this show, Khulod.
Thank you.
Let's start by asking you, why is Sudan where it is today?
I think at the heart of it, this is a contest between two parts of the same Sudanese military project. And this is a project that was designed and cultivated by successive regimes in Sudan, but has really sort of been focused and concentrated to do exactly what it's doing now by Omar al-Bashir. He had created distinct parts of the military to be, you know, against each other, but loyal to him. And now we're seeing those antagonisms that never really went away with his fall come to the fore. At the heart of it, Generals Burhan and Hemeti and their troops, as well as their sort of junior partners, what they want to do is avoid accountability in terms of justice and the money that they have taken from the Sudanese state and the Sudanese people, and to make sure that they don't face any kinds of repercussions for the many war crimes that they have committed together. And they want to, and they have very different visions about how to consolidate the coup that they led in 2021.
And what we are hearing from people in Sudan, the conflict had taken a different dimension, ethnic, you know, and in Darfur it's a different ball game. What should be done to stop this conflict?
Well, the thing is that, such like other conflicts of a similar nature, this could go on for a while, maybe even decades. So the focus now really has to be on protecting civilians as a priority. I don't think the warring parties either side is ready to meaningfully commit to a ceasefire. We have seen several ceasefires fail that were negotiated in Jeddah between the Americans and the Saudis alongside the two belligerent parties. That kind of setup, frankly, isn't equipped to bring about the kind of ceasefires that we want to see, because neither side will commit to a ceasefire until they know what a political settlement looks like. So unless the two tracks, a political settlement track and a ceasefire track, are well coordinated, we're not going to be able to see any movement on the ceasefire. What that means is we have to make sure that civilians are protected as much as possible, because this war isn't just being fought between the soldiers, it's also being fought on the civilians of Sudan.
And you were caught up in this conflict in April in Khartoum. 5 months down the lane, who is in control of Khartoum City? Both sides are claiming that they're in control, but
yes.
What are you hearing from those whom you've left behind? Who is in control of Khartoum?
It's difficult to say, because militarily speaking, the RSF has taken a lot of territory, a lot of grounds, particularly in Khartoum, and to some degree also in the other parts, Omdurman and Bahri. The military, the Sudan Armed Forces, retain some control of Omdurman. But frankly, no one is controlling that area beyond just having the territorial domination. There is no governing structure in place. There is no structure in place that protects people, that provides services. So no one's really in charge of Khartoum. It has now become effectively a wasteland, a battlefield that both sides are still fighting over. But what's clear is that with the exit of General Burhan from Khartoum and now residing in Port Sudan, the RSF has been making claims that it's effectively in charge of Khartoum and therefore has to some degree moved closer to victory. Now, I think they're able to hold, take territory. They're not really able to maintain it. So that's quite a bold claim.
And there are reports of atrocities allegedly committed by the two sides in Khartoum and in Darfur. Talk to us about that. What are people telling you?
I think the thing to remember here is that both Burhan and Hemeti cut their teeth, militarily speaking, on the war in Darfur. At the time, they were fighting on the same side on behalf of the Bashir government against the communities and rebel groups in Darfur. So this is something they know how to do, unfortunately, very well. And what we've seen this time around is that the war between these two different groups on Darfur, a place that had already been experiencing so many different and into sort of woven conflicts that had never really been resolved. And so this national war, this war at the national level, added another layer to what was already a very protracted and very difficult to resolve conflict. What this means for the citizens of Darfur is that their concerns and their needs have gone up exponentially, and their displacement, of course, similarly too. It's very difficult now to see how Darfur, peace can be brought to Darfur under the current circumstances.
And you're out here, a voice for the people of Sudan who are not able to speak to policymakers, to speak to the international community. What is the main ask of the Sudanese people at this time?
A lot of people just want the war to end. After that, there are some disagreements about what a future in Sudan looks like. I think that's perfectly normal. Sudan has been going through a lot of political tumult and change over the past few years. And, of course, people are going to have different ideas about what they would like to see. But at the heart of it, everyone believes, or a lot of people believe, not everyone, that the war should stop so that the country is given a chance to move forward. What we need from the international community is greater focus on Sudan, greater engagement with the level of atrocities that we're seeing, and work towards preventing those atrocities, and as I said earlier, a much greater focus on the protection of civilians.
And you're out here, you have a lot, you've lots of meetings, you're meeting influential people in Washington, and soon you'll be going to New York, I mean, meet the you know, world leaders. If there's one message that you want to give them, what would that message be?
I think it has to be quite a basic message at this point, unfortunately, which is do not forget the people of Sudan. You know, right now there are
Do you feel the people of Sudan are forgotten?
Absolutely. We're only 5 months into this conflict. It doesn't look like it's going to get any better. In fact, we're seeing much more fragmentation among some of the armed groups. We're seeing an ethnicization, a very ugly ethnicization of this conflict. And as I said, this could go on for potentially decades. But already 5 months in, we're not seeing Sudan get the level of attention that is commensurate to the level of destruction that we've seen. For example, 7.1 million people have now been displaced by the war in Sudan. That's higher than any population in the world, including Yemen, Syria, and Afghanistan. And yet we're not seeing, and Ukraine, and we're not seeing the level of attention that it should be getting. So really, the main message is do not forget the people of Sudan. As you said earlier, the Secretary General's representative, Volker Perthes, is now stepping down. This is, I think, a key opportunity for the United Nations to engage where it has been largely absent since the start of the war, and put in place an envoy that could really marshal international attention and action, more importantly, on Sudan. We're hoping that, particularly here in DC, that the US government will take the lead in doing so, because it has much more leverage and much more ability to corral international attention on Sudan than it currently is exercising.
And General Al-Burhan left Khartoum, went to Port Sudan, went to Egypt, went to Juba, went to
Ankara, Asmara, Doha.
Correct. I mean, what is the significance of these travels? What is he trying to do?
Well, if you notice, he's left behind his military uniform, he's wearing his suit. He's very much wanting to present himself as a legitimate authority in the country and not just as a belligerent party. the both generals are really striving for international legitimacy with this war. Both have been saying since the start that they want to continue and complete the revolution that was started by the Sudanese people. This means that getting them to acquiesce to some of the international demands, as well as the demands of the Sudanese people, lies in making sure that to what extent they can present themselves as legitimate is intimately tied into how we try and resolve this process. We know that this battle is being fought on three fronts. It's being fought in the battlefield. It's being fought on as an info war, a propaganda war. It's also being fought at the mediation table. At all of those, in all those fronts, we need to make sure that we are engaging with them in ways that are commensurate to what they've been doing in the country.
And yesterday, General Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo released a statement talking about possibility of forming a civilian-led government in Sudan. What are some of the sentiments from the pro-democracy groups about this? Because this was the ask of the pro-democracy groups, that they want a civilian-led government. Here, Himid is saying he's ready to form a parallel government in Sudan.
So Himid's observations, or his calls for a civilian government, came in response to Burhan quietly feeling out the potential to set up a new government in Port Sudan. Effectively, this was on the cards anyway, that with either side being able to have the level of military dominance to be able to declare a victory, we'd see this partition across the country. For Hemeti, Darfur was already in his zone of influence. He has now extended that to Khartoum, and he hopes now to consolidate that, enable and sort of set up some kind of government. The reality is he doesn't have the staff capacity to be able to set up a government. He doesn't know the first thing about governing, and neither, I think, do the people that he will put in position. Any government formed now, either by Hemeti or by Burhan, will be tainted by the stain of the war so far. So neither government will be in itself a legitimate government, nor a vehicle for legitimacy for either Burhan or Hemeti. Obviously, a lot of people in the country are now very concerned about what this government by Hemeti could mean, especially given the levels of abuses that we have seen and the atrocities that we have seen committed by the RSF, particularly in Darfur. So this is not at all comforting to, I think, the majority of Sudanese people.
And just a last question here. What are some of the, if you like, a rallying point for Sudanese right now? What brings Sudanese together? The pro-democracy, the former rebels, and the activists who were on the streets. What brings them together at this point?
You know, I think it's, unfortunately, there's very little sense of nationalism in Sudan. That is something that was sort of assiduously broken down by the Bashir regime. But what does exist and what does endure in Sudan is that people want to make sure that their families and their communities are looked after. But we need to make sure, as Sudanese people, that that is done in a way that is not, competitive, and therefore that does not fuel more conflict. I think we need to recognize that we all have a mutual fate here, and we need to use our strength in our abilities to look after each other and our communities, to be able to channel that into building a new nation.
Khaled Kheir, thank you very much for educating our listeners about this situation in Sudan. That's Khaled Kheir, the founding director of the Khartoum Think Tank Conference Advisory. She was with us here in the studio. That's all we prepared for you this Friday, September 15th. 2023. We now take you to Sudan's Blue Nile State with the song Salwa. Listening to a group from Sudan's Blue Nile State with the song Salwa. Don't forget to visit voafrica.com for all your favorite programs and news updates. If you miss this program, go to www.voaafrica.com/South Sudan. I'm your host, John Tanza, on this live broadcast from Studio 14 here in Washington. On behalf of our producer, Kwame Ofori, and our engineer, John, we wish you a lovely evening. Remember to tune again tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.